Hello, and welcome to our webinar, GPL Version 3, How Will It Impact Enterprise Organizations? I'm Linda Nicholson, OpenLogic's Director of Marketing. OpenLogic is a leading provider of open source solutions that enable enterprises to safely acquire, support, and control open source software. OpenLogic provides enterprises with a certified library of open source software that encompasses hundreds of the most popular open source packages. We provide indemnification on each of these packages, and our solution helps you enforce open source policies, thereby reducing the risk and maximizing the cost savings associated with using open source software. OpenLogic also provides enterprise-grade technical support backed by the OpenLogic expert community. We recently polled our expert community, and 70% of them told us they plan to move their projects to GPL V3 when it comes out. So we wanted to provide you with more information about the third revision to the GPL license. We have muted the lines for everyone except our moderators in order to eliminate any potential background noises that might interfere with the event. But at any time during the presentation, please click the question and answer icon on the left menu bar to ask a question. Questions of interest to the audience will be read aloud and answered by our speakers during the last 10 to 15 minutes of the presentation. And now I would like to introduce today's guest speaker, Evan Moglen, Chief Legal Counsel to the drafting of GPL Version 3, is a professor of law and legal history at Columbia University and is the founder, director, counsel, and chairman of Software Freedom Law Center, whose client list includes numerous pro bono clients, such as the Free Software Foundation. Professor Moglen has represented many of the world's leading free software developers. He has also held visiting appointments at Harvard University, Tel Aviv University, and the University of Virginia. In 2003, he was given the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Pioneer Award for efforts on behalf of freedom in the electronic society. And now, Evan Moglen.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate this opportunity to speak to you about GPL3. We're going to begin this session with a short poll of the audience to understand people's degree of involvement with GPL3 and its process, after which I'll return you to provide some overview of the GPL process and discuss the substance of the license. Thank you. That's a helpful summary of the situation. I'm interested that even as many as 2% of this group have submitted comments in the GPL3 process. That's useful to know. But as I expected, we are basically beginning from scratch. And what I would propose to do then is to start by talking a little bit about this GPL. If I might have, please, the first of our slides for this presentation. Yes, thank you. And the next. So the GPL, the GNU General Public License, was born of an idea in the mind of a single individual, Richard Stallman, the founder of the Free Software Foundation. In the early 1980s, Mr. Stallman was working at the MIT Artificial Intelligence Laboratory and was in daily contact with AT&T's Unix operating system, which was widely available to research institutions and universities around the world on terms which permitted those licensees access to source code. But AT&T's licensing provisions for that source code prohibited people from making modifications and sharing those modifications of Unix with others. Mr. Stallman realized that from his point of view, this was an ethical problem, a problem that challenged the conception of freedom as he understood it, in a world where human beings want to share general useful technical information about computers. And he conceived the idea of a general purpose operating system like Unix, compatible with Unix, but independently re-implemented from scratch and made available to everybody on terms that permitted everybody to copy, modify, and to share. An immensely talented technical architect and designer, Mr. Stallman conceived not only the whole of the GNU system, GNU stood for GNU's Not Unix, a programmer joke, a recursive acronym. He not only conceived of the technical content of GNU, but he also conceived of the social and licensing context in which such a project could be made to work. That required, from his point of view, copyright licensing arrangements which would protect indefinitely, perpetually, in the hands of all users, the right to copy, modify, and share. The first version of the GNU General Public License, which implemented this licensing strategy, was published in 1985. And the second version of the license, which is the current version, used all over the world, was published in 1991. The GNU GPL, or GPL as it is known pretty much everywhere on Earth, the GPL is the world's leading example of a copyleft programming license, a license which reverses the flow of rights under copyright so as to give all users the rights to copy, to modify, and to share, which under copyright statutes are exclusively vested in the original authors of created works. The GPL is currently used as a license on more than 75,000 programming projects around the world, many of them, like the Linux operating system kernel, the MySQL database engine, the GCCC compiler, products of enormous commercial value in use in almost every technically sophisticated enterprise in the world. Those projects under GPL reach from single programmer projects being worked on by garage inventors to projects like GCC and the Linux kernel, which are de facto industrial consortia activities for which many of the programmers are paid to work full time and which are themselves the cooperative output of a large number of vendors, users, research institutions, all sharing all the code. Version 2 of the GPL, which has subsidized and organized all of this activity, having been unrevised since 1991, is a license which has enabled growth in the use of the software it covers by almost 9 orders of magnitude in 15 years. We've gone from a world in which a few dozen people developed code under GPL to a world in which more than 1 million people have at one time or another worked, as best we can tell, on GPL licensed projects, and in which enormous numbers of users do enormous amounts of business using the software every single day. May I have the next slide, please? The process of renewing the license, of changing its content, updating it to current circumstances, is a process which has been more or less continuously underway since I began working with Mr. Stallman in late 1993. Over the course of the last 13 years, I think there has not been a single month in which we have not exchanged ideas or design considerations for the revision of the license. But even by the mid-1990s, at a time when commercial uptake was still substantially smaller than the business intelligence and surveillance of Microsoft could detect, even by the mid-1990s, it was clear to us that the process of revising to GPL3 was going to be a long and complicated process, which had to be carefully studied and pursued with great prudence. The amount of received expectations, impact of investments, business models built on GPL has grown explosively over the last 10 years. And when we began the process of public revision in January of 2006, We did so on the basis of years of pre-planning, both as to process and as to substance. There were three revision goals that were key to our understanding of what we were going to have to accomplish in moving GPL from version 2 to version 3. Those goals arose out of the changing circumstances in which GPL software was used around the world from the position in 1991. The first revision goal was to achieve globalization of the license. GPL version 2 was written by Mr. Stallman and U.S. Copyright Council. I had no role in the preparation of GPL version 2, but having worked with it intimately for years, I, like anyone lawyer who has touched it, was aware of the limitations that its uniquely U.S.-centric legal vocabulary imposed in working with lawyers and users outside the United States and outside the Anglo-American copyright system. So our first architectural goal in making GPL 3 was to render the license not merely comprehensible to, but usable by, lawyers and courts throughout the world. This is an unusual architectural concern. Most parties who license copyrighted works in the international context do so by creating one license per country, and they emit their works combined with the local license through a local distribution network. Therefore, each license under which their work is available is tailored to the local legal system where the work is published. But this is not a feasible approach for free software licensing. Our code follows arbitrary trajectories worked on by a programmer in Iceland, simultaneously with a programmer in New Zealand, alongside or in parallel to the work of a team in China or Kazakhstan or Germany or California. Our code moves among parties who use it across arbitrary trajectories. A tarball may be emailed from or FTP from hand to hand across any arbitrary set of borders before it reaches the hand of any particular user. So in order to globalize the license, particular new drafting structures were needed, and we came to that process through a long and complex study of how to internationalize copyright licensing in a way that few licensors ever undertake. A second fundamental revision goal in working with the GPL was to take account of the explosive and, from my client's point of view, very destructive move towards the large-scale patenting of software in the United States, the UK, and to a lesser extent elsewhere in the world. That underlying goal to prevent the patent system, with its tendency to turn software into 20-year monopolies on particular fundamental ideas, that underlying goal of providing patent defense appropriate to the very much enlarged environment of users in a very much intensified patent system was a primary goal in GPL 3. Lastly, GPL 3 needed to address a particular problem which arises from the spread of technical measures for the protection of entertainment bit streams. What has come to be known in the entertainment world as digital rights management, and among free software programmers is often referred to as digital restrictions. The problem that's posed by DRM is not an ideological objection to the technological protection of entertainment or other culture. Many free software programmers do have ideological objections to DRM as a concept involving music or movies, but that's not the concern of GPL. The concern of GPL is that as parties adopt technical measures for the protection of entertainment content, they choose to lock down the software stacks inside media centers, handheld devices that play music and movies, and the servers on which media content is stored. That lockdown is designed to prevent the modification of software which might weaken the digital restrictions that are applied to non-programmed copyrighted works. And for the free software programmer, this set lockdown, this prohibition on modifying code in devices that consumers use, threatens the very mechanism whereby free software is made. So the third primary revision design goal in GPL3 was to take measures to inhibit the use of GPL software in devices which do not permit their owners to modify and share embedded software. May I have the next slide, please? So now, with respect to these particular goals in the revision of the license, if I can turn to the globalization principle, may we have, please, the third slide. With respect to the globalization principle, it was evident that we were going to require a global process for revision of the license, involving a long consultation with lawyers around the world who could help us to understand the limitations of existing GPL and the drafting opportunities for GPL to come. With this in mind, we published at the end of November of 2005 a process document indicating both a schedule and a procedure for modification of GPL. That process called for a web-based commenting system which would allow individuals and organizations to offer comments on equal terms for inclusion in the analysis of the license draft. A schedule for the release of drafts and a structure for the formation of discussion committees, face-to-face and non-face-to-face meeting organizations capable of taking the general public comments and turning those public comments into issues which could be fleshed out and debated, with the result that the Free Software Foundation could make final reasoned decisions about the content of the license on the basis of the discussion committee versions of the issues. I have put before you on the slide the process deadlines as they evolved over the course of that year. We originally expected that final adoption date, currently 6/30/07, to occur some 90 days sooner, in the middle to late March of 2007. One delay occurred in the course of the process, which was a delay occasioned by the announcement in November of 2006 of a patent deal between Microsoft and Novell, which raised issues of particular concern to the GPL3 community and caused us to delay the final determination of the license in order to draft some remedial measures to deal with a patent threat of the kind that the Microsoft and Novell deal posed. With that one 90-day change in schedule, the process published in November of 2005 was and remains the blueprint for the process through which we have passed in 2006 and 2007. We announced the first discussion draft in January of 2006 and formed four discussion committees. Those committees were open to anybody who attended our inaugural meeting at MIT in January of 2006. And in addition to the attendees who came out of the Cambridge meeting, there were other invitees chosen by the committees themselves to supplement their numbers and increase their reach. In general, those committees had functional characteristics in common. One committee consisting of vendors and large-scale patent holders, a committee consisting of large users, public and private, and the council who represent them, a committee consisting of other free software projects outside of the Free Software Foundation's organization, projects which either made use of GPL or which interacted with GPL software while their projects published under other licenses, and a series of members of the free software community, individual hackers with strong credentials in the community, leaders of thought and opinion, whose influence on the license we believed would be particularly constructive. We've had more than 15,000 public comments on the license over the course of the last 16 months. Those 15,000 comments resolved themselves to more than 110 issues concerning the license's three discussion drafts. Those issues have been discussed in the discussion committees and have resulted in very substantial revisions of the license as we went along. Let me now turn to some particular aspects of that process. May I have slide 5, please? So let me turn first to the question of globalization of the license. As I previously described, the process of globalizing GPL is a process of removing from the license itself U.S.-centric legal language and concepts. Since the 1895 adoption of the Berne Convention on copyrights, to which the United States was the only major nation not a party until 1976, thanks to the Berne Convention, we have throughout the 20th century had a relatively harmonious global copyright system. That is, the Berne Convention establishes certain minimum toolkits for the production and distribution of copyrighted works. And any state which has acceded to the Berne Convention has a local legal system which implements those basic concepts, though it may implement them in locally unique ways. The goal of denationalizing the GPL is the goal of using the minimum Berne toolkit available everywhere to achieve more or less uniform results by not distorting the flow of global copyright through unique legal provisions drawn from a single legal system in the license. Our approach, therefore, was to take all US-centric vocabulary and legal concepts out of the license and replace them with concepts which rested on something other than a reference to a particular legal regime. In particular, every concept used in the new license is referable to a stated fact, verifiable in the world by a programmer who understands the way code works, and a reference to local copyright law, which allows anybody to consult any local copyright lawyer in any legal system around the world and get a correct answer. Let's take a couple of examples. May I have slide 6, please? So, for example, the GPL3 depends very heavily upon a basic concept, which is propagation of code. The GPL permits propagation and sets some conditions for propagations of particular kinds. But propagate, the word we chose to describe the fundamental activity of doing something with GPL code, is not a word which is used in any nation's copyright statutes. It's not distribution or the making of a derivative work. It's not public communication or making available. It isn't, in short, one of the concepts contained in somebody's copyright statute. Instead, it is defined as to do anything with a word which, if you have no permission, would subject you to liability under local copyright law. This allows a party anywhere in the world to ask the question, what do I have to do under this license, by asking first, am I propagating the code? Well, am I doing anything with the code? Am I changing it? Am I giving it to anybody? Am I doing anything with it which I would need permission for under local law? And then you can ask a local lawyer and get an answer. From propagation, we can now build up one more step. May I have slide 7, please? To convey, again, a word not present in anybody's copyright statute, to convey is now defined as propagating a work in any fashion which enables other parties to make or receive copies. merely interacting with code through a network is defined as not conveying code. Now it becomes possible to say, if you convey code, here are the rules which apply to your conveyance. Rather than asking, is code being distributed, a question which may be meaningless in a particular copyright law system, or may have an unexpected answer depending upon how the word distribution is used, the question becomes, did I propagate? Did it have the effect of allowing others to make or receive copies? Questions of fact and local law. This basic strategy, don't ask about matters in US or UK or French or German or Australian copyright terms. Ask instead questions based on fact, as viewed under local copyright law, and use units consisting of a fact plus a local principle to build up an overall set of rules and regulations. This is the structure employed in internationalizing GPL3. We know that this is a new and unusual exercise in international copyright instrument drafting, but it is already beginning to be adopted by others who have equally strong need for international drafting. Let me turn next to the subject of patent defense. May I have slide 8, please? Here, our goal is to provide the fullest possible form of communal defense against copyright, against patent aggression from within the community. In other words, you have a set of possibly hundreds of thousands of people, all of them with investment-backed expectations, time, money, value, need in their business, for the ability to copy, modify, and share freely. Your goal is to prevent any member of that community from defecting from the common purposes by aggressively using its own patent rights to make proprietary a program that others have built to be free. As a secondary goal, you want to prevent outsiders from the community, wherever possible, from taking advantage of their patents to treat the free software community under GPL in an anti-competitive, discriminatory fashion. This second goal, however, cannot be completely achieved within the scope of a copyright license. The copyright license can make rules for sharing within the community of people who adhere to the license, but it cannot readily make rules which will convey, which will constrain those parties who are not within the scope of the license themselves, who do not author or distribute code. So the first and most important element of the patent defense provisions of the GPL is to deal with those parties who actually interact with code to prevent them from defecting from the principle of freedom that the license is supposed to set up. Next slide, please. Here, our process of lengthy and complex conversation with the leading patent-holding parties in our community, most of whom are the leading IT vendors of the world, the IBM, Hewlett-Packard, and Fujitsu, Hitachi, Intel, Nokia parties, whose patent portfolios are deep and whose involvement with free software is constantly increasing. Here, the discussion path took us down a road of separating the members of the community into two classes, those who merely distribute GPL code without changing it, and those who change GPL code by contributing to it, as well as distributing onward the code that they have modified. May I have the next slide, please? With respect to those who merely distribute code, our goal is expressed in Section 10 of the license, which says, you may not impose further restrictions downstream from you of any kind beyond those imposed by this license. And in particular, you may not bring patent infringement actions against anybody to whom you have distributed this code for making use of it or for engaging in the expression of their rights to copy, modify, and redistribute. In essence, this could be seen as a simple invocation of the law of patent exhaustion. In the United States, we assume that a manufacturer is prohibited from bringing patent infringement actions against its own customers for patents practiced by what they have been sold. But patent exhaustion rules are not uniform around the world, and they do not necessarily capture all of the rights that GPL guarantees to downstream users. So distributors have a choice. If they wish to continue distributing the program, they must forego the exercise of their patent claims against that program or works based on that program pretty much in anybody's hands, because it can never be authoritatively shown how any particular party came into possession of a copy of a GPL work. For distributors who do not contribute any code to the program, however, it is possible for them to exercise their patent rights if they cease all distribution of the GPL work. Next slide, please. With respect to contributors, that is, parties who add code to GPL works, on the other hand, the obligation to provide access to patent claims is more significant and less reversible. Each contributor grants to each user of every GPL program a fully non-exclusive worldwide royalty-free patent license to make, use, sell, and etc. with respect to all essential patent claims. That is, all claims that would be infringed by use, copying, modification, or redistribution of the GPL work. So when parties contribute to GPL code, and when they release those contributions publicly, they are making a strong promise of patent security against any claims their work may practice with respect to anybody into whose hands that work may come. We are very pleased that we have been able to construct a global consensus behind these rules, embracing not merely free software developers, but the largest vendors in the world with the deepest patent portfolios, who have, at least in theory, the most at stake in a rule which requires large-scale dedication of patent rights to the communities that make and distribute GPL software. May I have the next slide, please? The matters I have so far discussed concern patent defense against internal members of the community who might defect from the general rule of reciprocity and deploy their patents to create leverage against those who copy, modify, and share. But the Novell and Microsoft deal proved to our community at large what the Free Software Foundation had long claimed, that anti-competitive behavior by a monopolist hostile to free software would likely take the form of an attempt to convert its patents into leverage within the community by way of alliance with some members of the community against others, the use of patents to divide and conquer. Though we originally proposed some general measures to protect against such behavior, the community at large greeted the FSF's initial drafts on this subject with skepticism. Such measures would be powerful, and were they really needed? They might have unintended consequences and serve little purpose, it was said. And then, as though to answer all objections, Microsoft moved, and the parties within whose community we were drafting this license began to see the need for increased security. Before you, you see the most important such measure taken in the GPL 3. If, pursuant to or in connection with a single transaction or arrangement, you convey or propagate a covered work and grant a patent license to some of the parties receiving the work, then the patent license you grant is automatically extended to all recipients of the covered work and works based on it. In plain blunt language, if you are Microsoft and you make a deal with Novell to give patent safety only to some of Novell's customers, then you are actually giving patent safety to all their customers, all the developers, and all of everybody else's customers, too. The effect is to turn the monopolist's intended leverage into protection for the community. May I have the next slide, please? And just in case anybody else thinks that making deals with Microsoft in this form is a good idea, we have added what I think of as the dancing with wolves provision, which says, in blunt language, I give you the less blunt language here, if you make deals with a party having patents, to pay tribute to that party in return for protecting some, but not all, of your customers. If you pay tribute to protect some, but not all, of your customers, you are violating the license and you must stop distributing altogether. This provision is not retroactive. It does not cover deals made in the past. It covers only deals made after the publication of the third discussion draft of GPL3, and it is designed to prevent the spread of such arrangements as are currently in existence between Microsoft and Novell. These provisions, too, given the conduct that Microsoft engaged in during the GPL3 drafting process, have largely been greeted uniformly with positive response within the GPL community. And as this week's most recent events have shown, there is already cause within the community to celebrate the GPL drafting process as providing further protection against saber-rattling by Microsoft, threatening to disrupt free software production through the invocation of a large inventory of most likely invalid patents. Let me turn then to the last of the major drafting goals of GPL3, that is lockdown. Next slide, please. The problem that DRM causes to free software developers, I should say again, is a problem which arises not because DRM is applied to a movie or to a musical work, but because in pursuit of a technological environment which will protect those digital restrictions, parties in the entertainment industry seek to have consumer electronics and IT manufacturers build devices that consumers cannot modify. IT and CE manufacturers, however, want to use free software because it's cheap, agile, and powerful. And they want to reserve the right to themselves to modify devices after sale, because in the current global commercial environment, devices that are not agile enough to be modified and enhanced after sale are devices that will be expected by their manufacturers to be discarded by consumers in favor of competing more agile products. So manufacturers are using free software embedded in devices precisely in order to achieve agility and modifiability for themselves. And the goal of GPL3 is to ensure that when a manufacturer makes a device that it can change after sale, the consumer too has the equivalent right to modify after sale that the manufacturer has. But for the manufacturers of IT goods in particular, there are classes of goods about which the consumer's right to modify after sale is a problem. And this has to do with the continuing interest of customers, large-scale enterprise customers, in purchasing secure business networks. Networks which resist foreign software, like malware, viruses, and worms, and which protect the data on those networks against transportation outside the business. The consequence is a powerful arrangement within GPL3 to differentiate the concerns of the IT industry from the concerns of the free software community. Next slide, please. What we have ultimately agreed upon is a provision prohibiting lockdown in consumer products, which says if you convey executables in or with or specifically for use in a user product, which is defined as a thing that people use in their daily lives, consumer products under warranty law, if you convey object code in a user product, and if you have the right as manufacturer to modify that code after sale, you must show the consumer how to do that too. You don't have to do it for every consumer. You only have to do it for consumers who request the source code, which under GPL they have a right to do. So if you buy a cell phone with Linux inside in the future, you should expect a postcard inside the box that says, there's free software in this cell phone. If you want the source code, send us this postcard and the cost of shipping and handling, and we'll send you the source code that's inside your phone. We'll also tell you how you can modify and install updated or changed or hacked versions of that software. Though note that if you modify the software, all bets are off with respect to your warranties. And if your phone misbehaves, we don't have to give you cell phone service on our network. Here, too, we are very pleased to be able to say that we have achieved a broad inter-industry consensus, which for the first time in the history of the DRM wars separates the IT and consumer electronics industries definitively from their sometime partners, sometime frenemies in the entertainment industries. We expect a broad variety of consumer products with GPL software inside, modifiable by consumers, notwithstanding the DRM inside them, to come to market in the next several years. And we believe that that rule of protecting user modifiability will turn out to be a commercial advantage rather than a commercial disadvantage for the manufacturers who have chosen to imply to include GPL software in their works. Now let me just spend one moment before taking questions on the issue of how GPL 3 will actually come into force. May I have, please, slide number 18. GPL version 2 in 1991 took account of the likelihood, indeed the certainty, of future versions of GPL. And GPL 2 therefore contains a rule already in existence, which people have had 15 years to study concerning how GPL 3 will be adopted. You see the text of that rule before you. If a program under GPL specifies that it is under GPL version 2 or any later version, then anybody who has a copy of that program may choose to use it and pass it along under GPL 3 the moment the license becomes effective. That is to say, not only the copyright holder, but other users as well have rights to relicense particular copies of the code. Only the copyright holder himself or herself can make a definitive move to GPL3 only. But almost all commercially significant GPL programs currently in circulation are circulated under GPLv2 or any later version, which means that once GPLv2 becomes formally an effective license of the Free Software Foundation, which we expect will happen at the end of next month, it will become possible for all individuals to begin using GPL software, almost all GPL software, under the terms of GPL3. There are only two significant commercial exceptions, the Linux operating system kernel and MySQL, which both are at present licensed GPLv2 only, and their copyright holders have sole discretion about which license will in future apply to their code. But for the vast bulk of GPL software, transition from one license to the next will be smooth, decentralized, and more or less automatic. That concludes the framed portion of this discussion. I now welcome any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Professor Moglen. We will be taking a question and answer session at the end of the webinar, and I wanted to remind participants that we do have a question and answer button on the left-hand menu of your screen, and if you could please just submit your questions through that method, then we will read them aloud at the end of the webinar. At this time, however, I'd like to introduce Stormy Peters. Stormy is OpenLogic's Director of Community and Partner Programs. She joined OpenLogic from Hewlett-Packard, where she founded and managed the Open Source Program Office. As an early adopter of open source, Stormy was responsible for HP's open source strategy, policy, and business practices. She was also a founding member of HP's Linux division. Stormy is a frequent keynote speaker on business aspects of open source software at major conferences such as the Open Source Business Conference and O'Reilly's conferences. She has addressed the United Nations, European Union, and various U.S. state governments on open source software. Stormy is a co-founder of the nonprofit GNOME Foundation, which is based on open source principles to encourage the development of a computing platform comprised of free software for use by the general public. And now, Stormy Peters.
Thanks, Linda. To those of you in the audience who have questions for Eben, I will keep this short, hopefully short as my intro. So I just wanted to talk. OpenLogic brought this webinar to you because our whole goal is to enable enterprises to safely and securely acquire open source software, manage it in their enterprise, and control it. And we realized that a lot of people had questions about GPL version 3, and that's why we're here. So what we do is we understand that enterprises want to use open source software. There's a lot of savings, a lot of faster time to market, a lot of reasons for enterprises to be using open source software, but there's a lot of uncertainty and risks that come up. And so our goal is to address those and to make it easy for enterprises to use open source software. So we go through the open source software that's out there, we evaluate it, we test it, we certify it, and we provide a tested and certified library of 250 open source software applications for enterprises to use, and then we give them the tools to manage that in their enterprise, know what's installed where, when there's new versions, and actually install it and integrate it, you know, with minimal technical problems, and thereby enabling enterprises to use open source software effectively, save money, get to market faster, whatever their goals were in using open source software. So I wanted to address some of the legal issues that we help with when we help with open source software. So first we help enterprises discover what they're using. We often find that many CIOs or CTOs know that they're using open source software. They're okay with that, but they don't really know what all they're using. So we have a discovery tool that runs on systems, either developer systems, IT systems, production systems, and generates a report of what's installed, what open source software is actually installed. Then we provide some policies and approval processes so they can say, I don't want any GPL licensed software on my systems, or I do want GPL licensed software, but I want you to send an email to this attorney every time it's used. Or we could say, you know, Fred's team is allowed to use GPL version 3 software, but Mike's team is not because they're shipping stuff to outside people and we don't want to open source our code at the moment. Then we have an audit, so you can see which licenses are installed in your software and where, and who installed them, and who approved it, and you can see the license text. Your attorney can say, generate a report of all of the licenses used in my enterprise, and show me the license text so that I can evaluate it. And then finally, we help address some of the legal risks associated with using open source software, kind of put people's mind at ease. So we offer full indemnification for all of the 250-plus products in our library, and that indemnification covers patents, copyrights, trademarks, and trade secrets, and it's at no additional cost if you've bought our solution. So I will move to the last slide before we get to the questions here. So why choose OpenLogic? To reduce the total cost of using open source software. So not only do you get all the advantages of using open source software, but it's cheaper for you to do it because we've addressed these problems for many enterprises. Make your staff more productive. They're going to use open source software that makes them more productive. They'll be able to use it with less problems. To make sure that you're compliant with all of the licenses, and to make sure that your policies are being put in place and that they're being followed. And then finally, to have a single source of support, both a knowledge base and a technical support for all of the open source software that you use in your enterprise. So with that, I will open up to questions for Evan. If you can go to the left-hand side, you'll see a question button. If you can click that, type in your questions, and I will be reading them out for Evan. Since we have over 100 people on the phone, we're not going to open the lines. So please type in your questions, and we'll get them answered here. So first question for you, Evan, is how do you address concerns about consumers' communication safety that have been addressed for enterprise users in the DRM provisions?
Well, the question, I think, basically means, do we have to worry that consumers are going to modify their hardware in such a way as either to turn it into a brick or to injure the networks over which they communicate? So far as we're concerned, preserving people's right to hack on the computers that they own is preserving a right which 99.9% of users never need and aren't threatened by. Those people out there who want to modify their cell phone so it works differently are a rare and unusual breed, but what they make, other people may discover they want to share. What we believe is that we're protecting the material of ordinary daily life as platforms for user innovation. We think that user innovation emerging from user communities is the primary source of innovation in the 21st century economy, not centralized innovation emerging from factories or engineering groups. Therefore, what we think we're really doing, rather than worrying consumers with dangers, is providing the innovative components in society, whether it is 9-year-olds in their homes or 20-year-olds in their schools, with an opportunity to make the innovations that everybody else will profit from later on. We think that 21st century R&D is an activity engaged in by creative and daring people. And they know who they are, and if they turn their cell phone into a brick, they're perfectly prepared to regard that as their problem.
Okay, thanks. Once GPL version 3 goes into effect, will further transactions by Novell and Microsoft under their deal be in violation of this, or will their deal still be considered under GPL 2 or earlier?
Novell's activity will be protected by the fact that it was complete as of the date in November, which is the effective date of their deal with Microsoft. Microsoft's activity will begin to disperse patent defenses into the community. When GPL3 goes into effect, every Microsoft coupon handed to somebody which results in the shipment of a Novell Server Edition product to that coupon holder will result in a conveyance of broad patent defenses to parties throughout the community. The goal of this provision was to incent Microsoft to get out of the patent deal with Novell. Microsoft, which fully understands what we are doing and why we are doing it, has elected instead not to withdraw from the deal with Novell, but to throw coupons wholesale out of airplanes. You have been watching for months as Microsoft gave away these coupons, which were supposed to be valuable to Microsoft and for which it paid a lot of money, as though the coupons themselves were hot, as indeed they are. All of this giving away coupons activity by Microsoft is meaningless and useless. The coupons have no expiration date, and Microsoft can be sure that some coupons will be turned into Novell in return for software after the effective date of GPL3. Once that has happened, patent defenses will, under the license, have moved out into the broad community and be available to anybody whom Microsoft should ever sue for infringement. Our goal, in other words, is to add one more layer of probable defense against the Microsoft patent aggression, which Microsoft has just been busy thumping its tub about this week. So, in summary, Novell will be protected for the long haul, and Microsoft will be endangered for the long haul by GPL3, and that's as it should be.
All right, thanks. I have a couple more questions. I'm trying to summarize a few here that are on the embedded software space. So this one reads, I'm an embedded software developer in a company that sells software to telecom companies. The telecom companies have stringent security requirements. For example, they can only use approved software versions can be installed on an embedded device. I'm afraid that the requirements in the GPL V3 that instructions must be included with each device how to install other software versions won't be accepted by our customers. What's your opinion about this, Professor Moglen?
We believe that some network operators acting within some local regulatory schemes will prefer to avoid GPL software in future as they prefer to avoid GPL software now. We believe that other manufacturers will elect to segregate address spaces within their phones so that the only portions of the phone address space that can be reflashed are the parts that contain GPL software that the manufacturer has elected to use. And those will be for such user interface functions as are non-critical to the performance of the phone's radio side. We believe that there are still other manufacturers who will jump at the opportunity to produce open devices and to engage in constructive dialogue with the regulators about how open devices can and should be integrated into the commercial infrastructure. So let's be clear about the timescales. Over the next couple of years, the penetration of Linux phones in the cell phone market is going to explode, but it will do so under controlled terms. Within 20 years, it is our belief that cell phones will have disappeared, that owned spectrum held by cell phone network operators will have disappeared, that bandwidth will belong to people as a right, not as a consequence of their ability to pay, and that the devices which people use for interpersonal connection in daily life will be largely deregulated, largely uncontrolled, freely modifiable, and that unless that happens, vast quantities of meaningful economic innovation in the 21st century would be strangled in the cradle. We have no love for the particulars of current telecommunications regulation doctrine, which we think is primarily for the benefit of incumbents. But the challenge that we are posing to the regulation is long-term. In the short term, it will be possible for people to make cheap, partially modifiable devices, which will stay on the right side of the regulators and which will draw the user community to the devices. Ask yourself this question: can Mr. Steve Jobs make an iPhone without GPL software? On your answer to that question, much depends.
All right, we still have a few questions, so if you have time, I'll continue to ask them.
Surely, it's my pleasure.
If we develop a Linux driver which runs in kernel space, does it need to be open source?
This is a question which depends upon the licensing policy of the developers of the Linux kernel, who have a policy which seems to go beyond that of GPL. If the license on the Linux kernel were pure GPL and no other exception had been given, the answer would be yes. Any driver meant to be integrated with the kernel would have to be not just open sourced, but licensed under GPL. The kernel developers, however, have had in place for years an informal and unwritten exception, apparently discretionary at its margins, which has permitted the combination with the kernel of non-GPL drivers. The kernel developers have evidently preferred what I think we might call constructive obscurity with respect to the full dimensions of their exception. Mr. Torvalds has sometimes said that it was limited by the derivative works rule in U.S. copyright law. He has sometimes said that it permitted any binary module which was not in bad taste. He has sometimes said that it permitted only the combination of modules which were in existence independent of the Linux kernel, which, for example, implemented file systems available in pre-Linux Unixes. And the kernel developers have also put a mechanism technically into the kernel capable of detecting the difference between GPL'd and non-GPL'd drivers. So my conclusion, I have never been the lawyer for the Linux kernel, and I am not responsible for the development or the implementation of this policy, but my understanding of the situation historically is that the kernel developers have chosen neither to forbid binary-only drivers to the kernel, nor have they chosen to endorse them. Some entities, such as Novell, have now announced that they will not support binary-only drivers connected to the kernel because of maintainability concerns. Some Linux distributions, such as Ubuntu, carefully differentiate between binary and free software drivers and tell the user at install time that binary drivers are disfavored, but nonetheless allow users to install binary drivers where they feel that it's important to attain hardware support, which can only be attained through the use of binary drivers. I will say for myself that I don't understand anybody's continuing to make and distribute binary drivers for the Linux kernel. It seems to me fundamentally a bad idea economically and technically at this point. There is so much development resource out there in the world that will work on and improve and maintain your drivers for free, that it is hard to conceive of a trade secret or other commercial advantage which outweighs the immense cost saving of community support. But there are still enterprises which believe that the secret of their hardware is more important than the free long-term maintainability of their software. And at the end, we'll see whether or not they were right.
All right, thanks. I'm going to switch back to devices now. And
yes.
This is a note. We had a note from the audience that somebody is works for a company that makes video routers as opposed to cell phones. So if that changes any of the answers, I just wanted to let you know that. So the next question is, if a consumer were to modify a device with GPL3 code, would there be any violation of the license if the manufacturer were to notify the consumer that they may no longer play DRM content?
No. If the way that the device works is that it permits the manufacturer to inspect whether changes have occurred in the software stack, and if it chooses to attempt, on the basis of what it knows about the status of the stack, not to present DRM content over a network, that may be in compliance with the license, which says that network services may be denied to a modified device if the device violates the rules of the network. But we're going to have, over the course of the next couple of years, a slow and careful opportunity to engage in dialogue among manufacturers and users with respect to where those lines are actually drawn, fact by fact. Manufacturers will have an equivalent opportunity now to experience the other alternative, which is the Windows Vista alternative, the alternative of computers extensively booby-trapped, so that every time a kid hacks a display device in Thailand, equipment stops working in Spitsbergen. We believe that Microsoft Vista is such an excellent example of why we are right and devices that are booby-trapped against their users are bad devices, that we think the market will have a clear opportunity to rule. And within a very short period of time, Microsoft will be proven to have made the mistake of its life, and we will have been proven to be where consumers actually want the world to go, in the direction of devices which are respectful of the needs of their owners. We think manufacturers will conclude that getting right with customers is more important than getting right with Disney. But Disney, of course, will do everything it can to prevent manufacturers from doing what their customers want.
So this next question is about internal distribution. Do GPL version 3 definitions of propagate or convey intend to obligate an enterprise to provide source code or patent license to third parties solely based upon modification and distribution of open source software internally within the enterprise?
No. Internal modification and use is a right, which from the point of view of the foundation has to be protected as firmly as any other right. You have a right to modify software and to use it without showing it to anybody. That's true under GPL2, and it's true under GPL3. You have no obligation ever to give source code to the general public. You only have an obligation to give source code to those to whom you give binaries. If you maintain privately trade secret modified versions of GPL software inside your enterprise, or if you are a government agency working within a structure of classification rules, or in other respects exist within a legal regime which regards a particular transfer as not a distribution under copyright law, then what you are engaged in is private modification, which the GPL believes you have rights to do and right to be protected in.
All right, so I'm going to take one last question here. If we modify any open source component, the modifications are to be distributed under GPL license. Does it mean that we must submit the modified component to open source community, even if the modifications are not generic and very proprietary changes to the open source component?
Unless you are distributing an executable form of the program you have modified to persons outside your organization, you've no obligation to distribute source code to anybody. If you are making proprietary modifications for your own use, you have no obligations to anyone. If you are making proprietary modifications to GPL works and distributing those works to others, then they aren't proprietary modifications, and you owe to the people who receive the executable the same thing you got, a right to study, modify, and share.
Thank you very much, Professor Moblin. That concludes our webinar for today. We will be posting the recorded version of the webinar and the slides on the openlogic.com website within the next 24 hours. Thank you for joining us today. Oh, also, I'm sorry, we will be sending out a survey later today or tomorrow, and we would like to ask you to please participate in the survey. It's regarding the GPL version 3, and we will share the results of the survey with anyone who does choose to participate.
We're going to quiz you on what you learned today.
Thank you.
Thank you.